Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, March 29th, 2018. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's start with announcements. Coming up this Saturday is the Sycamore Grove Cleanup. Come join us on March 31st from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. for Cesar Chavez Day and help give back to the land that provides us with our drinking water. The Sycamore Grove Cleanup Project aims to restore an area of public land along the San Lorenzo River near Highway 9 north of Santa Cruz. Restoring this sensitive riparian habitat will increase water quality in the river, therefore benefiting the wildlife that resides there, including anadromous species of fish. In addition, Sycamore Grove is directly upstream from the intake for the Santa Cruz City Water Department drinking water treatment plant, so restoring the area will also improve drinking water quality for the City of Santa Cruz residents. Under the guidance of Santa Cruz Park Rangers, volunteers will be picking up trash and removing it from the area. Gloves, trash grab sticks, and trash bags will be provided. The terrain is mostly flat, but can be steep in some areas. You need to sign up by going to the Santa Cruz VolunteerNow.org webpage. That's scvolunteernow.org. And hunt around under the City Serve programs for the Sycamore Grove cleanup. Once again, this Saturday, March 31st, 9 to 12. And Cascadia Forest Defenders invite you to a week-long climbing camp. Come spend time in the woods learning how to ascend and descend a static rope, traverse between trees, use a crossbow for tree entry, build and set a platform in a tree, build road blockades involving aerial structures, and much more. This is going to take place from April 23rd to April 29th. You need to RSVP. The email is forestdefensenow@gmail.com. forestdefensenow@gmail.com. So you can reserve a spot and find out how to get there. If you need more information, go to www.forestdefensenow.com. Once again, that's April 23rd through the 29th, somewhere in Cascadia. And the Southeast Trans Andor Women's Action Camp is taking place April 26th through the 29th in Western North Carolina. Local community organizers will be hosting a rural and urban direct action camp in so-called Asheville, North Carolina from April 26th through the 29th. The camp is open to all female, trans, trans women, trans men, gender queer, gender variant, two-spirited, agender, or otherwise non-cis male identifying people. The Trans Women's Action Camp is an approach to smashing patriarchy and opposing all forms of oppression through direct action, skill sharing, and mutual aid for the sake of the individual and collective liberation for all. Again, you need to reply to them to get information and to RSVP. The email, or excuse me, the webpage is setwac.blackblogs.org. setwac.blackblogs.org. And once again, that's April 26th through the 29th in North Carolina. And the American Bird Conservancy is looking for a Bird Smart Wind campaign director. The director of American Bird Conservancy's Bird Smart Wind Energy campaign works to minimize the impact of birds caused by the development of wind power and associated electrical transmission lines and towers. The program focuses on establishing mitigation requirements and regulations to protect birds at wind energy facilities and addressing the mostly poorly sited wind projects to protect threatened and endangered species, eagles, and other federally protected birds. The position requires excellent advocacy and communication experience, strong writing skills, and a broad knowledge of renewable energy development and bird collisions. If you'd like a complete job description and how to apply, please go to abcbirds.org/about/employment/job-16969. Once again, that email address, abcbirds.org/about/employment/job-16969. And here's the update from the field, from the Buffalo Field Campaign. The Gardner Basin has changed rapidly in the past months. Just a few short weeks ago, 800 gentle giants were roaming freely throughout the basin. Outside of the trap where those confined for slaughter, old family groups were seen in every direction from north to south. In the last weeks of March, some were taken by hunters, but the majority started their southward migration towards Yellowstone's interior, heading for spring calving grounds. The Gardner Basin is nearly empty of buffalo now. This week's Gardner Patrol had some time to venture into the park to check on the buffalo who had moved on. We visited the northern herd members traveling through the Blacktail Plateau, where we saw a few hundred, thankfully including a lot of pregnant bull females. They were entering their calving grounds and preparing to give birth in the next few weeks. We traveled farther south into the Lamar Valley, where we saw fewer family groups towards the northern edge of the Lamar. There were tons of buffalo sighed, but we were encountering mostly mature bulls who look like winter has really taken a heavy toll on them. Ribs and hip bones are protruding. They are doing their best to keep themselves alive until the sun enables the regreening of the earth, when buffalo can get fat again. Outside the dangers of management, early spring is the most deadly time for buffalo, as many will succumb to the challenges of a long winter. In the higher elevations of the Hebgen Basin west of Yellowstone, spring migration is on the verge of happening. We had a few false starts as family member groups began to arrive, then disappeared, hopefully going to get friends, letting them know that the coast is clear and it's all right now to make their way towards their calving grounds on and around Horse Butte. The buffalo migrating west are all from the imperiled central herd, who were not spared by hunting or slaughter. We are anxious to see how many buffalo migrate west this spring. Over the past few springs, those numbers have dwindled, and we fear that after this intense killing spree, their numbers will be far fewer. Snow is rapidly melting, and the season of mud is upon us. With temperatures still freezing at night, it's a hard time for grazing under such conditions, and the best food is found along the banks of creeks, rivers, and their tributaries. Soon the snow will give way to the waxing sun, who will work his magic, wakening the life-giving green and growing ones who have been asleep for so long. For more information, go to their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And a judge has set aside charges in a pipeline protest in this story from the Boston Herald, written by Jordan Graham. A Boston judge has cleared a group of climate protesters who were facing criminal charges stemming from a 2016 protest over a pipeline in West Roxbury, citing the necessity of their actions in a potentially landmark ruling. It may be, well, the first of its kind in a case involving climate change, in that it's a judicial recognition of the measures that we need to take to address climate change, said Andrew Fisher, an attorney for some of the defendants. In that sense, it is a revolutionary step. The protesters, including Karina Gore, the daughter of former Vice President Al Gore, were facing charges of trespassing and disturbing the peace after climbing into a construction trench for the pipeline. On Tuesday, prosecutors asked a judge to convert the criminal charges into civil infractions, saying in the event of a conviction, they were unlikely to ask for further punishment. After allowing the motion, Judge Mary Ann Driscoll found the defendants not responsible, saying she agreed with their argument that their actions were necessary to combat climate change. Based on the very heartfelt expressions of the defendants who believe, and I don't question their beliefs in any respect, who believe in their cause because they believe they are entitled to invoke the necessity defense, I'll accept what they said, Driscoll said. Defendants argued that they were left with no choice because the pipeline was going forward despite the near-universal opposition from politicians from the city council all the way up to Congress. The protest was an act of civil disobedience to say it was necessary that we pay attention, Gore told the judge. Now is the time to pay attention and to change course is what is needed because it's a moral and ethical issue. And pipeline protesters have set up a new blockade to defend Peters as tree sits enter their second month. In this story from the Earth First Newswire, earlier this morning, anti-pipeline activists erected an aerial blockade across an access road in the Jefferson National Forest. The blockade prevents state vehicles and Mountain Valley Pipeline personnel from accessing the two tree sits on Peters Mountain and halts the daily construction of a 7-mile road leading to the site of the company's planned boring operation through Peters Mountain. One pipeline fighter sits atop a lone 50-foot log attached to nearby trees with a banner that reads, "The fire is catching, no pipelines." A rally of dozens of supporters has already gathered at the blockade. The tree sits, which have now occupied for 30 days, are currently preventing MVP's tree-clearing operation near the pipeline's planned crossing of the Appalachian National Scenic Trail. Mountain Valley has only 3 more days to fell trees before a federally mandated March 31st deadline to protect endangered species imposes a long delay. The pipeline fighter in today's action hopes to inspire others to take action to prevent construction of the pipeline. As I remember the local support the tree sits have received and all the people already standing up against the destruction of their land and water along the MVP and ACP routes, I know we can be a strong force for a world without these pipelines. Flames of resistance are catching and they will spread, said the pipeline fighter. The ongoing tree sits have enjoyed strong support from local residents in both Virginia and West Virginia, many of whom have opposed Mountain Valley Pipeline's plans to build a 300-mile, 42-inch high-pressure natural gas pipeline through their communities. And Sea Shepherd has saved 25 critically endangered Tituba fish at the height of the spawning season. March 26, San Felipe, Baja California, Mexico. Sea Shepherd vessel MV Sharpie came upon an illegal gillnet in the Vaquita Refuge in the northern Sea of Cortez, Mexico. The gillnet was entangled in a long line. As the ship's crew began to separate the illegal fishing gear, they noticed live Tituba bass in the net, embarking on an unprecedented rescue operation. It is the height of Tituba bass spawning season in the upper Gulf of California when the endangered fish migrate directly to an area inhabited by the vaquita porpoise. The vaquita is currently the most endangered marine mammal in the world and continues to be threatened as bycatch by the illegal Tituba trade. Tensions are rising in the upper Gulf of California. Poachers have become more aggressive towards Sea Shepherd vessels, using firearms to shoot down drones and incendiary objects to intimidate the crew. Thanks to the addition of armed enforcement agents and an emboldened pact with Mexico's Environment and Fisheries Ministry, Federal Environmental Attorney's Office, and Federal Police, security has drastically improved, allowing Sea Shepherd to continue its important work protecting the Vaquita Refuge. The Tituba bass is highly sought after due to its valuable swim bladder. Much like sharks and rhino horns, Tituba bladders are sold in Asian markets as a medical quackery. One Tituba bladder can sell for upwards of $10,000 in Asia. Although poachers in the Gulf of California see only a fraction of the street plays, they do well by local standards, which has added the Tituba to the economies of extinction, consequently pushing the Vaquita porpoise to the brink of extinction as a tragic side effect. All seemed normal on the evening of March 25th as the Sea Shepherd MV Sharpie patrolled the protected Vaquita area looking for illegal activity. The ship's captain, Franck Martin from France, spotted a net by deciphering the ship's sonar data, a new method developed by Sea Shepherd in recent months. It was a challenge to maintain the ship's position in the strong current while the crew pulled the net and saved the fish quickly and efficiently, while at the same time keeping the long line taut enough so it would not entangle our propeller, said Captain French. Adding, the coordination of the crew and the authorities on board was intense. Everybody was involved in focus. It was an all-hands-on-deck moment, and the crew did an amazing job with extracting an extraordinary outcome of saving every single Totoba in the net. This has never happened before. From Biteback, we hear the following news in an anonymous report from Unoffensive Animal. During the night, and with the owls and wild boar accompanying us, we decided to topple and destroy as many hunting towers as we possibly could find. We split into teams and divided the terrain to be more effective. Armed with handsaws, we cut the legs and toppled dozens of towers that were simply waiting for us to push them to the ground. Hunting, like any other oppressive system, will not be tolerated. Facing the inactivity and the lack of compassion by the so-called authorities, direct action is the only way of ensuring the safety of those who are prosecuted for the mere act of being wild. Signed, Until All Are Free. And drier conditions could doom Colorado spruce and fir trees in this story from the University of Colorado at Boulder. Drier summers and a decline in average snowpack over the past 40 years have severely hampered the establishment of two foundational tree species in subalpine regions of Colorado's Front Range, suggesting that climate warming is already taking a toll on forest health in some areas of the southern Rocky Mountains. Drier summers and a decline in average snowpack over the past 40 years have severely hampered the establishment of two foundational tree species in subalpine regions of Colorado's Front Range, suggesting that climate warming is already taking place. The findings, which were published in the journal Ecology, show that spruce and fir tree establishment was limited to a handful of years with above-average snowpack and cooler and wetter summer conditions, all of which have grown scarcer in recent decades. The study is believed to be the first to reconstruct establishment frequency on an annual basis for the two conifer species. Since 1975, there have been fewer favorable years for seeding establishment, said Robert Andrus, leading author of the study and a graduate researcher at Colorado University Boulder's Department of Geography. Our study indicates that moisture availability is the key driver for these events in Colorado's high forests. Rising temperatures have increased the rate of tree mortality across the entire American West, including subalpine forests in the Colorado Front Range, making it imperative for spruces and firs to establish successfully and regularly in order to replace fallen cohorts. In subalpine coniferous forests, seeding establishment occurs when large quantities of available seeds coincide with favorable climate conditions. And can damaged ecosystems be restored? In this story from the Environmental News Network. Across the globe, billions of dollars are spent annually on repairing ecosystems damaged by people, forests denuded by logging, rivers polluted by industry, grasslands converted to agriculture. A new meta-analysis of 400 studies that document recovery from such large-scale disturbances worldwide suggests that while ecosystems can bounce back, they rarely mend completely, with the final stages of recovery being the most difficult. Surprisingly, the new study found that more costly active restoration efforts did not consistently result in faster or more complete recovery. Our study suggests that in many cases, once damaging activities are halted, the most economically expedient restoration strategy might be to just let the ecosystems repair themselves, according to Northern Illinois scientist Holly Jones. She led a team of researchers from five countries in the study, published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B. And peak poop? Climbers of the tallest mountain in the U.S. have been told to take their poop home in this story from The Guardian. Climbers who come from around the world to tackle America's tallest mountain face packing out more of their own human waste after an expert found that a glacier in which much of it has been dumped is probably not breaking it down. National Park Service rangers trying to protect the spectacular slopes of Denali, formerly known as Mount McKinley, in Alaska are concerned that human poop is blighting the environment there. Michael Loso, a glacial geologist, calculates that 36,000 mountaineers attempting to reach the treacherous peak since 1951 and 2012 had deposited up to 215,000 pounds of human waste on the Kahiltna Glacier, one of the most popular summit routes. Since 2007, the National Park Service has required that climbers keep waste off the mountain's surface. Alpiners have captured their poop in biodegradable bags and then pitched it into deep crevasses on the glacier. However, Losa's research indicates human waste never reaches the bottom of the glacier and will never fully disintegrate. He warns that the prospect of the waste reappearing downstream as stains on the glacial surface in an otherwise beautiful wilderness landscape. Officials are now proposing new regulations instructing climbers to drop their waste in only one high crevasse, where a huge ice cliff is thought to pulverize the poop and render it inert. Climbers would have to carry out the rest of their waste. Beyond the aesthetics, climbers on Denali obtain all their drinking water by melting snow, which, if it is contaminated with excrement, can spread bacterial illnesses, which could be deadly at altitude. Each year in the short climbing season, about 1,100 people with permits attempt the Denali summit at 20,310 feet. More than 90% use a route starting from a landing strip for small aircraft on Kahiltna Glacier, flying in from the settlement of Talkeetna, north of Anchorage. Starting in 2007, the National Park Service required that human waste be collected in clean mountain cans, a portable toilet invented by a Denali Park ranger that resembles an extended coffee can. Loso tested human poop on the mountain and found that after a year, bacteria in the waste had not broken down. And from Science Daily, we read that the largest Chinook salmon are disappearing from the West Coast. The largest and oldest Chinook salmon, fish known as kings and prized for their exceptional size, has mostly disappeared along the west coast of the United States. That's the main finding of a new University of Washington-led study published February 27th in the journal Fish and Fisheries. The researchers analyzed nearly 40 years of data from hatchery and wild Chinook populations from California to Alaska, looking broadly at patterns that emerged over the course of four decades and across thousands of miles of coastland. In general, Chinook salmon populations from Alaska showed the biggest reductions in age and size, with Washington salmon a close second. Chinook are known for being the largest Pacific salmon, and they are highly valued because they are so large, said lead author Jean Olberger, a research scientist with the University of Washington School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. The largest fish are disappearing, and that affects subsistence and recreational fisheries that target those individuals. Chinook salmon are born in freshwater rivers and streams, then migrate to the ocean, where they spend most of their lives feeding and growing to their spectacular body sizes. Each population's lifestyle in the ocean varies, mainly depending on where they can find food. California Chinook salmon tend to stay in the marine waters off the coast, while Oregon and Washington fish often migrate thousands of miles northward along the west coast to the Gulf of Alaska, where they feed. Western Alaskan populations tend to travel to the Bering Sea. After 1 to 5 years in the ocean, the fish return to their home streams, where they then spawn and die. And this news from Science News, that noise from ships scares porpoises. Porpoises communicate with each other using sound. Therefore, they are highly sensitive to noise such as ship noise. And the Danish belts and sounds that are some of the most heavily trafficked waters in the world. An international research team led by researchers from Aarhus University tags on the backs of 7 porpoises with the aim of obtaining insight into how they react to disturbance of normal living conditions by ship noise. The groundbreaking data are published in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society B, with postdoc Danuta Wisniewska as main author. For many years, the research team headed by senior researcher Jonas Thielmann, Department of Biosciences, Aarhus University, has cooperated closely with Danish pound net fishermen, as porpoises are sometimes actually caught in pound nets. A fast phone call to the researchers and their speedy response ensure that the team can be at the site within a few hours. The porpoise is lifted out of the water in a net and into the fishing boat, where its size, sex, and health are determined before the new collaborative partner is fitted with an electronic tagging device by means of suction cups. The electronic tags record the sounds from the animals and noise from ships and allow the researchers to see when the porpoises feed and the depth at which they stay. The extensive data makes it possible for the first time to see how ship noise affects the movement and feeding of the porpoises. When the ship noise exceeds a certain level, the porpoises stop feeding. At very high sound levels, the animals dive to the bottom and move fastly along, and they cease emitting the biosonar clicking sounds they use when searching for food, said author Jonas Thielmann. The porpoise is Denmark's smallest whale, and researchers have long been concerned about how its living conditions are influenced by the intensified human activity at sea. Our measurements show that the porpoises do respond to heavy ship noise. It is still too early to say, though, what this means to the well-being of the porpoises, their production of offspring, and in the long term, their survival, said Professor Peter Telberg of Madison, Aarhus University, who is one of the researchers behind the sensational findings. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. You could also tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 a.m., KBOG 97.9 in Bandon, Oregon, Fridays at 10 a.m. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. You could also listen to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, or Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California. Please check their webpages for the date and time. You could also tune in to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, for all.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous Earth First Update edition. I'd like to please ask you to talk to your local nonprofit community radio station and get them to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.